Welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Nick Hilton and I'm joined now by Isabel Hardman and James Forsyth. So Priti Patel, the International Development Secretary, has found herself in hot water thanks to an unscheduled trip to Israel. What's happened?
So Priti Patel went on holiday to Israel, and on her holiday she chose to meet a whole panoply of figures from Israeli politics, up to and including the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The problem with this is that she didn't tell the Foreign Office she was planning to see these people before she saw them. When she was asked about this by The Guardian on Friday, she suggested, I think actually said, that she had told the Foreign Office beforehand, so it was all fine. It turns out she hadn't, and this is causing an understandable stink at Westminster, because what on earth is going on when cabinet ministers are kind of running their own freelance foreign policy, going and seeing people without referring back to the centre of government?
So, Isabel, was this just a completely credible holiday where one meets Benjamin Netanyahu, or was this somewhere where she was actually getting policy ideas?
Well, I mean, you know, everyone bumps into Netanyahu on holiday, don't they? But she did come back, and this is one of the problems with her meetings, that she didn't tell the Foreign Office about. She came back with policy ideas, it seems. So she suggested giving international development budget money to a refugee camp that the Israeli government is running in the Golan Heights, which isn't actually recognised as by the Foreign Office as being part of Israel. It's considered occupied territory. And this is why the row has become quite so serious, because it's not just meetings to sort of understand the lie of the land. It's also meetings that seem to have been influencing policy, which haven't been recorded officially.
And in other cabinet on the point of implosion news, Boris Johnson's found himself pulling what is being called a gaffe, although it seems to be a little bit more serious than that.
Basically, Boris Johnson went before the Foreign Affairs Select Committee last week, and he was asked about the fate of a British-Iranian dual national who is being detained by the Iranian authorities. And Boris Johnson said, you know, that she was teaching journalism, which is what the Iranians have accused her of doing, and are charging her with, but something that she and her employers fervently deny that she was. This has led to her husband being outraged, saying that the Iranians could increase her prison sentence because of this. She appeared in court again in Iran after his appearance before the Select Committee. Now, look, Boris Johnson obviously got this wrong, but I think we need to take a step back here and look at the responsibility or otherwise of the actions of some of the politicians involved. Emily Thornberry last night wrote to Boris Johnson saying essentially that if the Iranians were to increase this woman's prison sentence, Boris Johnson should resign. That is essentially, unless you have an absurd level of confidence in the independence of the Iranian judicial system, that is essentially giving Tehran a veto on who the British Foreign Secretary is. You are encouraging them to say, if we give her an increased sentence, Boris will have to go. Or if we don't, he can stay. And I think one of the things that people aren't realising here is people are so determined to pile in, but they're not thinking about the consequences of our actions. The Iranians take these dual nationals hostage, because essentially hostage, as pawns in a diplomatic game. By reacting like this, you are increasing the Iranians' perception of this poor person's value. Now, I can understand why her husband is so distraught. Who wouldn't be? And Boris Johnson obviously should have watched his language more carefully. But some of the other politicians piling into this should think about what the ramifications of what they're doing are.
But we do, as you say, James, we do have to remember that the person whose fault this is originally is Boris Johnson's.
Well, the person whose fault this is originally is the Iranian government for detaining someone.
Sure, but you want a foreign secretary who's going to be able to handle these reasonably frequent incidents where other governments have a disagreement over the human rights of someone who is in the country who happens to be a British citizen. And I think this, from a political point, I mean, from a, you know, the point of view of the impact on the British mother, who is now facing a further 5 years in prison, I think it's, you know, it's a horrendous blunder by Boris. But in terms of the political impact on him, it does feed into the narrative, which is already pretty strong, that he's not taking being foreign secretary seriously. And there have been a few anecdotes, a few stories about how he's managed to offend people here, make the wrong comment there. And all of these have been quite sort of low level. Some of them have been a bit debatable, actually, as to whether reciting Kipling, for instance, is really considered as offensive as it was written up to be. But this is kind of unequivocally bad. And you want a foreign secretary who you're not nervous about sending overseas. And it does seem to be that actually Boris is someone who, you know, he's had all the media training in the world, but he still manages to slip up in a select committee hearing.
Isabel's undoubtedly right that this is unequivocally bad. And it would have been much, much better if he had got this right in the first place, obviously, given the gravity of the issue. I just think that some of the people who are weighing in on this aren't happy. I also think on the Kipling point, there's an interesting point that I didn't realise until I actually read the New Statesman's kind of hit job on Boris this week, which is the reason he was quoting it was that at the dinner the night before, Aung San Suu Kyi had recited the poem. So if this poem is so offensive that it cannot be said, why was Aung San Suu Kyi reciting it at a dinner the night before?
One of the things to come of this is that two of the credible candidates to be Theresa May's successor are slipping up and perhaps finding their positions under threat. How long can Theresa May hold this cabinet together when we saw Michael Fallon go last week and two of the big dogs are in trouble this week?
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary that one of the nicknames for the scandal that's been raging in Westminster this week has been Pestminster, but I think it's much bigger than that. I think we're actually in Messminster now, that there are just so many rows on different fronts. Two secretaries of state who are in trouble for interfering or blundering on foreign policy in a way that they shouldn't have done. You've got the defence secretary has had to leave. You've got Downing Street terrified about more resignations, unable to do the big reshuffle that had been briefed at the start of this autumn because of the fear that someone might come forward about someone who's just been promoted and say, hang on a second, he did this to me 3 years ago, here's my story. And then you'd have to move that minister again. And actually, that the aim of the government now seems to be just to get through each day in a stagnant state. And that seems to be its top aspiration in terms of policy making, in terms of responding to some of the challenges that this country has, social care, NHS funding. You know, I'm sure there will be announcements on that in the budget, but they looked very much to be announcements that will stop another row from happening. Similarly on housing, Philip Hammond having a fight with Theresa May over liberalisation of planning laws because she doesn't want a row, because this government is now desperate to add any more rows onto the sort of, as the straw that would break the camel's back.
What's really keeping Downing Street up at night, though, I think, is this the Damian Green situation under investigation by the Cabinet Office, because unlike the other, Theresa May didn't inherit Damian Green. She brought Damian Green into the Cabinet for the first time. After the election, she made him First Secretary of State. If he has to go, I think, first of all, it reflects directly on her judgment. People will say, why did you give this person a job? You've known him since university. How did you not know about this aspect of his character that you've now is deemed incompatible with holding this office? And then, I think, crucially coming on to Isabel's point, Damian Green is the person designed to prevent blockages in Downing Street. He is the person, he is essentially meant to be the kind of, to provide the extra bandwidth. And he's the person who's trusted enough by Theresa May to basically ensure that the kind of flow of government decision making doesn't dry up. You know, it's him who is in charge of trying to get a kind of social care policy together, which everyone in government can agree with. If he is taken off the pitch, what I heard a lot from ministers this weekend is, you know, how will the government function if you remove Damian Green? I mean, it's, you know,
how many jobs can you give to Gavin Williamson to hold the government together?
Yes, indeed. I mean, it's kind of, you know, to kind of carry on with a bandwidth analogy, you know, if you unplug Damian Green, you really are kind of going back to the kind of dial-up modem and kind of waiting for the kind of crackling noise before you're going to get a decision. And this is why, you know, it is so difficult. But the nightmare for Theresa May, I think, and you have to kind of feel sorry for her, is that she, in this respect, which is she's just sitting there waiting to find out what Sue Gray concludes. And, you know, someone on Whitehall this morning told me that it was kind of the view in the Cabinet Office is it's 50-50 whether he survives or not. And that, you know, that cannot be easy for
Theresa May. Has also proposed a cross-party look at the culture that's developed in Westminster and whether there can be measures taken to tackle it. it feels at the moment as though most of the scrutiny has fallen on the Conservatives, certainly in their hierarchy. So why is it that the Tories are taking the most political heat on this issue at the moment?
I think there are several reasons. The first is the Tories are in government, and what happens to the government is naturally more interesting than what happens to the opposition. Secondly, I think that in a slight parallel with the expenses scandal, there seem to be more Tory cases, even if the kind of word in Westminster is that some of the more serious cases are Labour cases. That, you know, that there's a greater number of Tory cases. There are a greater number of, it seems there are a greater number of Tories who've said, you know, inappropriate things. I also think that one of the rules of journalism is that the journalists like stories that they've seen before. And right now, it is very tempting for journalists to view this as the 1990s redux. You know, you've got a Tory government split over Europe and engulfed in a sleaze scandal. And I think that is one of the other reasons why the Tories are having more of a problem with this at the moment than the other parties are.
Talking of stories we've seen before, the Paradise Papers, which seem to be the Panama Papers Mark II, are sort of burying the lead on the Priti Patel and Boris Johnson stories to some extent, with the BBC pushing them very heavily. Is there a sense that the BBC are sort of serving up the government's dead cat for them?
I don't mean that's how the BBC intended. And I think that, you know, I think if you're a Corbynite, you know, there's a reason why Jeremy Corbyn led on this very techie stuff about the Isle of Man and VAT on private jets at BMQs the other week. You know, the idea that the system is rotten, so pull the whole thing down, obviously plays to his narrative. I find these Paradise Papers completely underwhelming as a story in comparison to the Panama Papers. There seems to be kind of far less kind of clear-cut wrongdoing in this, and the people involved, you know, I don't think Lord Ashcroft being investigated by the BBC over his tax affairs is one of the most shocking developments we've seen in recent years. And, you know, at the moment I'm kind of, you know, I also think this, which is the stuff about the Queen, it's not like she's kind of won a bunch of money on the 330 at Sandown and shoved it in an offshore bank account.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Isabel. And you can subscribe to this podcast, Coffeehouse Shots, on the iTunes store and to the magazine itself from just £1 a week at spectator.co.uk/podoffer. And we'll even throw in a limited edition Spectator Moleskine notebook.